Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. A proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Today is Sunday, July 2nd, 2006, and this is show number 50. Wow, 50 shows! And it seems like just yesterday it was 49. Well, speaking of episode 49, how did you like hearing episode 48 twice instead? I can't believe that for 47 consecutive shows, I made no catastrophic mistakes that wrecked the feed, then twice in a row I messed up. Jeez, for the previous week, I had an excuse. I mean, I was trying to get it done in the morning. I was rushing out to this wedding and everything like I talked about. But last week, I don't have any excuses. I just blew it. Anyway, I enjoyed the emails I got about it. This one from listener Rose taught me some new Australian lingo as I read it. She said, I was going to email you, but thought I'd check your website first and found out that you'd messed up again. I'm laughing at you, but crying with you. Have you visited the MacCast site lately? I wanted to tell you about it because Adam stuffed up, which I thought would make you feel better, because if the Mac geek can stuff up, then anyone can. One of the things I love about the Mac community is that even the Uber geeks aren't up themselves. Is that an Aussie saying? Everybody seems so nice and humble and helpful. Anywho, hang in there because we're all looking forward to the next NoSillaCast adventure. Well, it did sure make me feel better that Adam stuffed up as well. Thanks for the moral support, Rose. Listener Jeremy made me laugh. He said, I thought I was losing my marbles, as twice I thought I'd screwed up loading the wrong episode into my Nano. This morning I made sure to load the correct episode, only to get the same result. This time I realized that the senior moment was mine, was not mine, but actually yours. I was about to post a concern on it when I saw your apology this evening. I resubscribed, so tomorrow I hope to hear an intro other than Father's Day, blah, 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 and your wedding trip. Blah, blah, blah. Are you insinuating that I blather on a bit? Oh, no worries. I bore myself sometimes. Jeremy went on to ask for some help on a kind of scary request. At least I thought it was scary. He's got an out-of-warranty PowerBook battery, and he doesn't want to shell out the big bucks for a new one. But instead, he wants to actually replace the battery cells that are inside. He opened his battery pack up, and he says, there are 6 lithium-ion type battery cells, type 18650. They look a bit like AA batteries with tags on each end to facilitate soldering. They are, if I remember correctly, 3.6 volts each. Therefore, multiply that 6 batteries minus a couple of volts for the diodes, etc., and that's the voltage of the pack. Not at all scary. Well, you know, Jeremy, from where I'm sitting, the danger of blowing up a $2,000 laptop by building a battery yourself is scary. Well, anyway, he wants to find a supplier for the lithium-ion battery cells, type 18650, in either the UK or continental Europe. If anyone out there knows a good supplier, shoot me an email at allison@podfeet.com and we'll get Jeremy in touch with you. One other thing you might consider, Jeremy, is picking up a third-party battery. I've used a company called Laptops for Less at laptopsforless.com once before, and they show the 15-inch aluminum PowerBook battery for $99 instead of $129 from Apple. Not a huge savings, but still better than full list price. Listener Scott, who turned me on to the Star Travel program Celestia that I reviewed last week, gave me some pointers on how to use the tool. One thing he suggested was trashing the plist file out of the library's preferences folder, and when I did do that, the crashes stopped on the program. So, evidently, it got horked up on that first launcher in the installation process. Normally, the first thing I do is throw away a plist file, but since I had just installed it and it was crashing, it didn't occur to me. But now it's pretty stable. He also gave me some hints about how to navigate around the program. You remember I was complaining about how it would take me around to the dark side of a planet or plot me inside a planet. He gave these instructions. To navigate to a planet, for example, the planet Mars, you must first hit the return key. You'll see a target window pop up and type Mars and hit return again. Now hit the G key. I'm assuming G is for go. This will zoom you directly in front of the big red planet. And it worked. That was pretty fun. So he also showed me how to rotate around a planet by holding down the shift key and hitting the left and right arrow keys. That was pretty cool. It did get scary after that, though, because he showed me how to speed up the Mars orbit by hitting the L key, which speeds it up by 10x. If you hit it often enough, you can make yourself really sick, especially if you hit the M key, which shows the moons around the planets, or the O key, which is even better, which shows all the moons, comets, spacecrafts, everything that orbits the planet itself. Thanks for all the tips, Scott. This is way more fun to play with now. See, I knew I wouldn't end up having to read the manual after all. Listener Bill wrote in with another program similar to Celestia. It's, again, open source, and it's called Stellarium from stellarium.org. Stellarium runs under Linux, Windows, and OS X, so you've got to love that. I should make sure it's clear about these programs. The views of the planets and stars in these programs are not real photographs, but they're beautiful and placed correctly, I assume, so it's still fun. Stellarium is around 18 megabytes and is a universal binary. That means it does run natively on both the PowerPC and the Intel boxes if you download the Macintosh version. Unfortunately, I was never able to get Stellarium to launch. It would paint the window black, then paint it blue, and then the program would crash. I did delete the plist file because I learned from what Scott told me last week, and I did edit the .ini file that they put on my Mac to set it to the widescreen resolution of the 15-inch PowerBook, but it still wouldn't launch. I checked the forums, and others were reporting the same thing. So one of the developers had weighed in and said that using the emulated version under Rosetta was the only workaround for now. I think I'll wait till I have a little more time to play with this and download a different version, then I'll do a more complete review. Thanks, Bill, for the idea, though. You know how I love open source cross-platform software. Listener Chris from Pennsylvania wrote in about an interesting problem/solution he had using Parallels. Here's his letter. Given all the fun we're having using Parallels, I really like it a lot. This is an excerpt from a post I made on a Parallels forum in response to someone who asked about what to do to be ready for or aware of as they try Parallels. One thing he suggests is looking at thinking about Parallels and CDs. He says, I was trying to burn a playlist from iTunes in OS X, but I received a message saying burn already in progress. I had to suspend my virtual parallel session, and then the burn occurred without incident. I was actually not using the Windows XP parallel session at the time, but it wrecked it anyway. That is an example of the things you just have to be ready for when attaching devices, or in this case, inserting a blank CD. Chris says he's an avid listener to the podcast and says thanks. Well, thank you, Chris. I'm glad you like the podcast. It's such a blast doing it, but it really charges me up when I get nice emails like yours. That's an interesting problem you had and a creative solution. I wouldn't have thought you could suspend and then go right back to the burn. You're right to point out that having two separate operating systems running can make things interesting, to say the least. I only discovered the idea of suspending the operating system this week. That's where you put the Windows away so that when you bring it up the next time, it pops right up instead of waiting for Windows to boot. I found that the time it takes to suspend is really long, though, and it chews up both processors completely while it's doing that, so I can't do anything else while it's working on that. My solution is that I just never shut Parallels down. I keep it up in the background, and I just hide it so I don't have to look at it, and most of the time it doesn't chew up the processors. I'm running CentOS Linux right now, and for some reason that one was chewing up the processors when I wasn't using it. Not quite sure why. Corey Mitchell of Bellamax wrote in that he heard my review of their product Upshot last week. That's the Windows-only software that has some really great algorithms for editing photos that I reviewed. I brought up a concern that Bellamax appears to keep three copies of the photos beyond the original, and that I thought this would eat up a lot of disk space. Corey wrote back, "We are making small copies of the file called proxies. We do this to preserve your original image. These proxy images, by design, will never exceed 1,200 pixels in the maximum image dimension. So they'll never be more than 1.4 meg uncompressed and around 200K because they are compressed. They will never be the same size as your full image unless your image is that small. Well, I decided to take a look at the size of these files because I thought they were pretty big. So I took a photo that I edited in Upshot. It was 724K for my original file, and that's a 5-megapixel pixel photo that I had compressed to level 8 JPEG in Photoshop. So remember, my original file is 724K. In Bellamex, it created an original folder, which the file was nearly a little bit over a megabyte. Then I did some red eye correction, so it created another file in the red eye folder that was another megabyte. And then it had an enhanced folder that was 1.2 meg. So my original file was 724K, but they added 3.3 megs of total file space taken up by these pictures. So they basically increased the size of the amount of disk space used by 4.5 times. I wrote back and told them, I don't think this is a minor inconvenience. That's a non-starter for me. I take thousands of pictures a year. I can't have 4.5 times my disk space taken up. So I was hoping that they could get some focus on this flaw because the algorithms for photo editing look to be really good. The other thing that was kind of odd that Corey said was that they're not working on a Mac version, even though the CEO told me they were. Evidently, that idea was shelved at some point and she missed a memo. From a technical perspective, I'm surprised that this is such a big deal. If the code is Java-based, it shouldn't be that hard. I know Java's not the magic ease that Sun promised us all for Java code. It still shouldn't be that hard. Heck, why even bother to write it in Java if you're going to make software only for one operating system? Well, I wrote all those comments back to Corey, and he came back with an interesting explanation about the file sizes. He said, thanks for your additional feedback. We made a fundamental decision to work on proxies requiring the saving of multiple copies. This serves the consumer in many ways, notably full experimentation without risk to the original. Now, my editorial comment here is, I never objected to having a copy of the file. I understand that. It's 3 extra copies that bothers me that are bigger than the original. So Corey goes on to say, there is the storage reality. Please be assured that our foremost product work involves reducing the footprint, improving speed and overall performance, including reducing the proxy file sizes. One final point he made was, as the original file increases, the proxy saved are not proportionally large, but much smaller, allowing large numbers of large files without an extraordinary hit to storage. I understand, however, that this doesn't solve your overall issue, Allison. Our proprietary FastFix and other tools offer a lot for photo hobbyists. We hope you'll continue to follow our progress with Upshot. Well, I'm pretty happy Corey came back with more information here because it shows that they're really interested in feedback and are working the issues. I'm definitely going to keep an eye on Bellamex and Upshot. Still hope they come out with that Mac version, though. Well, I'm sure by now, unless you're hiding under a rock, you've heard that Bill Gates is giving up his day job to do philanthropy full-time and that his buddy Warren Buffett is giving up 85% of his fortune, or $30 billion, to give to the Gates Foundation. I just want to make a little note here that just 2 weeks before Bill Gates announced this, I got to meet him and I thanked him for what he's doing for World Health. I'm not saying I made the decision for him, but it's clear I had a significant role in getting him to do this full time. I just wish I could say that I talked to Warren Buffett too. All right, on a more serious note, this week Apple came out with update 10.4.7, and while some folks have had trouble with this installation, ZDNet is reporting that there is an attack that goes after just the vulnerability that the update fixes. I put a link to the full article at ZDNet, but the gist of it is that the malicious program takes advantage of a locally exploitable vulnerability in an operating system component called LaunchD. Well, previous attacks on OS X have been on vulnerabilities that were patched ages before the exploit came out, like the highly publicized Nkana worm that came out 8 months after Apple had patched it. However, Apple was only a day ahead of this vulnerability. It's too bad there are frequent issues with updates breaking other things, but this one seems worth doing. Remember to fix your disk permissions before you run it and after running the update, but I always forget to do that, so do as I say, not as I do. And of course, it's a good excuse to run a good backup before you run the update too. If I've made it too hard for you with the disk permissions and the backups, just go ahead and run the update. Just take your chances on that, because this vulnerability doesn't sound like any fun. A couple of weeks ago, I showed off a site that had was a Google mashup that let you put a pin in a map to show someone where you were trying to point to. But it was kind of clumsy, and it only let you put in one pin. Turns out there's a lot of cool mashups popping up, so I wanted to tell you about a few sites where you can look for mashups that interest you. The first I went to was gmapsmania.com. I looked through some of the mashups and found quite a few that interested me. There's one to track the Tour de France, which sounded awesome, but I couldn't really quite figure out the map. It showed what the markers meant, like start and finish for each daily path, but when I looked on the map, I couldn't find any start and finish little markers, so not quite sure why that wasn't working for me. Probably user error. So they said this is updated each day, and that would be cool to be able to track the race, but only if you're smarter than me at figuring it out. One mashup I really did like was called Quick Maps, and it's QUIKmaps.com, which is just what it says. You zoom to an area that you want to map, and then you can add all different colors and sizes and shapes of markers, even stars, along with text labels. And you can even draw on the map with lines or squiggly lines. Once you have the map the way you like it, you can save it to mail the link to someone, or you can save it and generate code to put it on your website. I made one to illustrate how it looks, and I put the code in the show notes. I drew a map of how to get from the Apple Store in San Francisco from Moscone Center for the next time you go to Macworld Expo. I did find that the hardest part was drawing lines. I never got the straight ones to work, and the squiggly ones were kind of hit and miss. You can see I've got two or three little craggy-looking lines there. Didn't work very well for me. When it first generated the code for me, it was way zoomed out again, like the whole U.S. showing. So I zoomed back in and it changed the code for me, so it did work. The site does not require a user ID to create and save maps, but once you close your browser, your maps will become uneditable. If you sign up with a permanent ID, you'll be able to save and edit maps later. Well, I thought Quick Maps was pretty good, but then I found an even cooler mashup to do this called CommunityWalk.com. CommunityWalk has way more features and builds some really interesting functionality right into it. First, you put markers on the map, and for each marker, you can add a ton of information. You put in a description, a URL to a website. You can even upload a picture you took or link to one that's on the web. You can easily draw a path between markers, and then it creates something really cool when you do that. It creates kind of a visual timeline-looking thing. It's not timeline, it's really a distance line, and it shows the distance between your markers. This is a really cool way to show walking or driving distances between the things you're showing on your mashup. And it's all automatic. It looks really cool, and it's got the little markers above it on the distance line. It's very cool. So you can click on those markers, and the map will jump to that location. You can add categories to your different markers, too. So if you want to show restaurants or parks or whatever, then you'll be able to turn them on and off by category. I created a map that showed how to get from the Jewelry Exchange in downtown LA, my favorite place for my husband to shop, over to the Staples Center, home to the formerly world champion Los Angeles Lakers. I put a link in the map to the show notes. But there's one buggy thing about it. For some reason, the default view is way out on the Antelope Freeway, which is really far from downtown LA. So to get to the right place in the map, you have to click on one of the marker links in the distance line viewers. This happens even though I did select a save default view when I was building the map. It's probably just a little bug. But in any case, this is a really fun tool, and people have made some awesome maps, which you can go view at communitywalk.com. Like the author created one where he walked around San Francisco and he took pictures at all these different cool sites like the cannery and of the bridge and all that kind of thing. So it's kind of fun because you can see restaurants and places that he marked. It's pretty cool. Again, in this site, you can also make maps without logging in, but if you want to edit them later, you do need a login name. I put a link to the map I made in the show notes, so you can head on over to gmapsmania.com and see what other things people are creating and what you can do yourself. Walter Mossberg of the Wall Street Journal did a review this week of an interesting tool site called Tableau.com. That's T-A-B-B-L-O.com. Tableau helps you set up, take a set of photos and create a large poster that tells your story about them. As they say on the Tableau site, you can start with professionally designed templates and powerful editing tools to compose online photo albums or tableaus. Your tableaus can be shared with friends and family, printed as posters or prints, or published to blogs or websites. One of the things that helps to show you what you can do is they've posted tons of people's tableaus so you can get a feel for the creative things you can make. One of the tableaus has a stark black background with dramatic scenery and people, very artsy-fartsy, and the next one is a bunch of drunk guys having a going-away party for one of their buddies with a bunch of text about how much fun they had. Some people put in a lot of text like that to describe each photo, while others, like the Cleveland Botanical Gardens tableau, pieced all the photos together like a puzzle so there's no empty space at all on the page. I tried making a couple of tableaus of my own, and I found it extremely intuitive and fun to do. It took about 32 seconds to upload a little over 1 megabyte of photos, so it was pretty quick. Once you upload the photos, you can choose a layout and background colors to tailor the look to just what you want. Once your pictures are in place, you can make a lot of interesting edits to them. You can pan and zoom around in each photo. You can add effects like black and white or sepia tones. You can change them to look like a painting, or you can even make them look like a negative, which is dorky, but it's kind of fun. You'll push the button. You know you will. Anyway, so once you're in the photos, you can pan and zoom around them. You can slide the photos around. You can make them big or small. You can add captions. And it's all in that Web 2.0 feel where it doesn't repaint each time you change something. Instead, it smoothly moves things around. I had so much fun, I made 2 tableaus, one using pictures from Steve's Digicam's desk picture of the day, and one with pictures of my son Kyle in a soccer tournament. There's links in the show notes to both of those tableaus. The Tableau site works well like a social networking site as well, so you can have a circle of friends with whom you can share. You can create a blog and all of those kinds of things. Head on over to Tableau.com and get creative. If you do make one, send me a link so I can show it off on the site. Well, everyone's sending around YouTube videos, me included. I think I reviewed about 17 of them last week. So I decided to see myself how well it works. I went into the YouTube website, and first they made me create a login name, which does make sense since I'm going to be hosting them in my own area there. And they sent me an email to confirm the address. You gotta do that to make sure it's real. Well, it's easy enough to do the next step if your spam filters don't block it, so you don't steam around for a full day wondering where your invite went. Okay, so I went over and saw the spam filter and I pulled it back out of there. But once I was in, there was a very nice interface in terms of it has real obvious tabs to click, like one of them's called Upload. Well, that sounds like a good place to start, right? So first, I had to title my video, enter a description, and then put in tags that can be used for searching along with a video category. You don't have to worry too much about the tags and descriptions because you can go back and edit those later if you don't like what you picked. Well, I was now ready to upload the video file, which is limited to 100 megabytes and 10 minutes long. That's a good thing because nobody wants to watch this stuff more than 10 minutes anyway. They did let me decide whether I wanted it to be public or private. And for private viewing, I was able to create a contact list of family and friends to whom I could send the links. Again, if you change your mind later, you can still change all of these things. Throughout the site, there are warnings about not uploading copyrighted or obscene material. Pretty much every time you turn around, you're going to see a warning about that. I was then faced with more fields to fill out if I wanted, such as a date and location recorded, and a country and zip code. Once I uploaded the video, I was anxious to watch it, but it took several hours before it was really available to view. Not quite sure that was, but hey, it's a free service, so who's complaining? One of the coolest things they do is they give you HTML to embed in your own website so you can have the video play right there. It's literally as easy as cutting and pasting to get it done. I chose a video of my daughter Lindsay from a few years ago where she actually shot a goal as goalie, shooting from her own goal. It's a cool little video, and the soundtrack of the videographer Karen makes it even more enjoyable. Her voice is hilarious in the background as it's happening. Anyway, if you look in the show notes, you can see that I pasted in the HTML YouTube provided, and now the video plays right inside the show notes. Well, so far, this was a pretty trivial, easy interface, so I can see how so many people are uploading video. I decided to hunt around and see what else you can do. One tab is Home, and in there you can view your own videos, create playlists of videos you like, and then go back and pull the direct link to your videos so you can mail them to your friends. There's a lot of features of, you know, social networking, kind of MySpace sort of things, like you can create a blog, you can change your background colors, invite friends, exchange messages, and even subscribe to people's YouTube videos. If you want to check out mine, go to youtube.com/user/nosilicast. By the way, YouTube is spelled YouTube. I had a lot of fun in there. I bet if you get in there, you're going to want to fool around with it too. The next application might be the single coolest thing we've ever gotten from Research Department Niraj. It's called Cool Iris Previews from cooliris.com. That's COOLIRIS.com. This is one of those little applications that does one little narrow thing, but it does it so well, you just have to have it. Unfortunately, it's OS X only, but it's so cool, I have to review it anyway. Cool Iris is a set of free browser extensions that let you see the underlying content of links without actually clicking. Sounds complicated, but what it means is that when you come up with the results of a search, say on Google, you can simply hover over a link and Cool Iris will make this window jump out on the right side of your screen, showing you what you'd see if you had actually clicked the link. It comes up really fast and eliminates the need to click and then click back when it turns out to be not what you wanted. Imagine all those times when you clicked on a search result only to find out it was that annoying about.com, which you never want to go to anyway. Imagine if you had Cool Iris running, you would never have gone there in the first place because you'd see their stupid logo come up and you'd just jump right off of that link. Cool Iris Previews is supposed to work in Firefox as well as Safari, but I could only get it to work in Safari. It puts a little Enable Cool Iris Previews choice in your view menu on Safari, but in Firefox, it's supposed to put a little checkbox in the bottom right for it, and there's nothing on my Firefox window that I can find. The Cool Iris website says it supports Google, eBay, Craigslist, Delicious, and more. I tested it on Google, and I'll never give it up. It's an awesome time saver. Might even be enough to get me to switch back to Safari as my default browser. I just loved it. Well, it's a long weekend here in the United States because of our Independence Day celebration. It's hot and sunny out, so I'm actually going to wrap it up a little bit early here. I want to get outside and play. So, that's going to wrap it up for this week's episode of the NoSillaCast. And I just love that we're getting so much great feedback and people sending in cool tools they're using. That's fantastic, especially the open source ones that are cross-platform. Remember, you can email me at allison@podfeet.com. And now you can leave me audio feedback as well at nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.